Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Thanks, everyone, for being here. We're going to go ahead and start with our public hearings. And just for everyone's knowledge, we are doing public hearings on Senate Bill 890 and 899. We do not have the paperwork on either of those two bills at this point. We'll do our hearing on 927, and we do have paperwork, so we can move that, and that's the chair's plan, as well as Senate Bill 769. We do have all the paperwork. That's for work session. So with that, let's go ahead and start with, since Senator Taylor's here, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 890.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 890 comes to you from Senator Taylor, and it deals with sharing of legally privileged information between potentially city attorneys and elected auditors. You have a dash one amendment that further clarifies that the privilege is not waived when the records or information disclosed is for the purpose of an audit or investigation.
All right. Thank you, Senator.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And were you going to lead us off?
I think so. Okay. Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Kathleen Taylor, District 21. As you know, I think several of you know, my professional background is as a management auditor in the public sector, and I'm here today with Mary Calvera and Ms. Edwards from the City of Portland. Mary here is the elected city auditor for the City of Portland, and we are all here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 890. Taxpayers expect auditors to provide rigorous oversight of government programs. An auditor's ability to do this work depends on unfettered access to agency records. At the absence of statutory protections preserving privilege, agencies are able to withhold legally privileged information from auditors out of concern that sharing it waives the agency's privilege. This leads to potentially incomplete or inaccurate audits and investigations, which in turn may prevent agencies from identifying problems and improving performance. Senate Bill 890 safeguards access to information for elected city auditors by providing that their office's review of privileged information in the course of an audit or investigation does not waive the city's privilege. Senate Bill 890 ensures that elected city auditors and their staff have access to information they need to do their job. I'm very pleased to support and encourage the committee to do so as well. Finally, I'd like to mention there is a dash one amendment that further narrows the concept by ensuring it only applies to those specific records and information disclosed for the purpose of the auditor investigation, and I support the adoption of the amendment. I'm going to turn things over to the City of Portland Auditor and Elizabeth Edwards to go into greater detail, answer any questions, and I want to thank Chair Brzezinski and the members of the committee for hearing the bill, please.
Thank you very much. And Senator Taylor, are you going to be able to stay for questions later?
Yeah.
Okay. Who'd like to go next?
Well, for the record, Elizabeth Edwards with the City of Portland. I want to thank Senator Taylor for her leadership on this bill and wanted to introduce our city elected auditor, Mary Caballero. And because the bill is short, I will keep my comments very brief. It's simply about providing statutory assurances to our auditor in order to increase access to documents and records and increase the oversight that she has. So with that, I will leave it to our auditor, and I will be here for questions.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Hall Caballero, and I'm the elected auditor of the City of Portland. And I'm here to urge your support for Senate Bill 890. It is critical to my office's ability to hold city government accountable on behalf of the public. The City of Portland's auditor is elected to act as the watchdog over the city's executive branch. The auditor's office conducts oversight through a unique combination of accountability tools. In addition to performance audits, we investigate police conduct and monitor officer-involved shootings. Our ombudsman investigates complaints from members of the public who believe the city has treated them unjustly or unfairly, and we enforce lobbyist regulations. To do this work effectively, we require complete, unfiltered, and timely access to information and records. The public expects that our audits and investigations draw on all, not just some, of the facts. They expect the auditor's office to decide when information is relevant to a particular audit or investigation, not the agencies that are subject to our oversight. The need to review legally privileged information comes up most frequently in the context of our investigations, but it also comes up in audits. For example, we are currently auditing the city's risk management office, which assesses the public's liability claims against the city. Many of risk management's records contain privileged information. The city is withholding certain records to preserve that privilege. Without access to this information, a critical city function involving millions in tax dollars may not receive the level of scrutiny that the public expects. I am mindful of the need to protect legal privilege, particularly when the city is involved in litigation and should remain on an even playing field with its courtroom opponents. But holding government accountable and protecting the city's legal position need not be mutually exclusive. Senate Bill 890 is the right fix. It is a narrowly tailored proposal that is modeled after similar provisions in Oregon law and other jurisdictions. The bill would ensure that my office's review of legally privileged information in the course of conducting audits and investigations would not waive the city's privilege. Passage would be a net gain for government transparency and accountability. We are very grateful to Senator Taylor for her support and for drafting this bill, and we thank you for the opportunity to testify before this committee, and I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, thank you very much. Open up for questions, and I see Senator Manning first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Just had one question. You know, while I do think that this is a good bill, I was just wondering if you've coordinated with other offices throughout Oregon, or is this Portland specific?
This bill is drafted to be specific to the elected auditor in the city of Portland. And the reason that is because our office is unique in the state of Oregon, and actually might even be unique in the country, with all of the accountability tools that fall under the jurisdiction of the auditor. So a lot of audit offices do not have an ombudsman. They don't do police oversight. And so they have a more streamlined audit-only purpose. And my office has a range of things, including the lobbyist registration program, where we are doing a variety of investigations in addition to audits. And so it really is tailored specifically for the city of Portland.
Just one quick follow-up. Uh-huh. Okay, so since it's really unique to Portland, would a state statute or state law, how would that impact all other audit offices throughout Oregon, or will that have an impact on all the other auditors that haven't had the opportunity to come forward and buy in?
Chair, I'm going to defer to
Chair Senator Manning. At the request of other stakeholders, we purposely drafted the bill extremely narrowly, and so it is specific to a city elected auditor. And based on a survey of our colleagues, the city of Portland is actually the only entity to have a city elected auditor.
So any other, if other cities that go to a elected position for auditors, then it would apply to them, or it'd be open to them?
Chair, Senator, yes. They would also enjoy the statutory assurances provided under this bill.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Lithicum.
Just a comment. Thanks for that clarification. As you're describing, it's tailored for Portland. I'm looking at the text. It's very short and narrow, and I'm thinking Portland doesn't show up in here. Your explanation for elected auditor position as the narrowing scope doesn't really apply only to Oregon. It just so happens Oregon's the only city that has an elected auditor.
Portland.
What did I say?
Oregon.
Oh, yeah, thanks.
Yeah. So I think that's the unique part here, is, and this is the part for new members. When you have legislative council draft these type of bills, they usually do not name a city per se.
Correct.
They have something that, as you said, is a limitation, and a lot of times it's by population.
Right. In this elected phrase, as the narrowing.
Yeah.
Agent item in the text, I didn't recognize. Thank you.
Yeah. Senator?
Chair Pazanski, I just wanted to also clarify that Ms. Edwards is referring, in this case, yes, the City of Portland auditor is elected. Metro, for the metropolitan area, that auditor is elected. The county auditor for Multnomah County and other counties is also elected. And what's unusual in Oregon, though, is that the Secretary of State oversees audits, but we do not have a state-elected auditor for the state of Oregon. So I just wanted to, there are other elected auditors within the state system. What I think the distinction here, just so everyone is clear, is that the city of Portland has responsibilities, as Mary has mentioned here, that other audit divisions do not have. So Multnomah County, if there's a complaint about the sheriff or something like that, they don't go and do the investigation of the sheriff in the Multnomah County Audits Division the way that the city of Portland does. That's what makes it a unique office. And so having access to these records, when you're talking about, did the police behave appropriately? Did they store their guns correctly? Did they do things like that? They need to be able to interview people, see documents, et cetera. So that's just wanted to clarify, because they have a wider range of responsibilities than the state audits division does, or the Multnomah County or something like that. So.
All right, I guess. I'm going to ask for one other clarification. So basically, it's also my understanding the distinction here is because it is a municipality that does have an elected official as an auditor. And it's the only one in the state that we know of at this point. And because of that that structure, it's the auditor's office isn't part of the umbrella of the rest of the executive branch in the sense of Portland. And that's the issue, I think, as to why you're having the reluctance of having certain documents come to you, because if you were actually appointed or hired as an employee of the city through the mayor or council, I think that protection's there, and that's, I would assume, part of the reason why you're not having cooperation of getting sensitive privileged documents.
Chair Pruzanski, I think it's some of that is correct, and then also the way our city attorney's office has interpreted the privilege issues is that it is a close circle of people who enjoy that privilege. It is not the entire city of Portland. You right. have to have some mm-hmm. connection to the topic. And so I don't think necessarily that it's because I am not part of the executive branch that that's occurring. It's because I'm not part of the variety of decisions that are being made on a daily basis that the city attorney's office is advising staff. And so it's just the way that the privilege works.
Okay.
And we would just like it to be extended to us for accountability purposes.
Right, and I just want to set the record so we know why we're doing it and what we think the reasons and need for the bill.
Okay.
Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I was just going to make the point that, you know, I really appreciate the independence that the auditor has by being an elected official, but there are downsides to it that I think this bill is seeking to rectify. I will add, we're also very fortunate to have Mary Hall Caballero as our auditor to exercise that independence with courage and persistence.
Other questions or comments? Ladies, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 890? Not seeing anyone coming forward. We're going to go and close the public hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You bet. And as I stated, we don't have the paperwork, but as soon as we have the paperwork, we'll go ahead and get it scheduled for a work session.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we're going to go and open up our next public hearing, which will be Senate Bill 899. I believe Michael's doing this one.
That one's me.
That's okay,
yep.
Shannon.
Chair Pruzanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 899 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. The underlying bill establishes a task force. This is a placeholder for the very large, I believe, 53-page amendment on the dash ones, which is the Oregon Receivership Code.
All right. So we have three individuals who would like to come up all together. So Mark, Tyler, and Andrea, they're here. Excellent. And let me just go ahead and ask for whoever wants to start off to give us your name, and we'll move forward from there.
Okay. Well, good morning, Chair Pruzanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee. My name's Tyler Skidmore, and I am currently a second-year law student at Willamette University College of Law, as well as an extern with the Oregon Law Commission. My interests post-grad are generally involved with the legislature, and so working with the commission has been a great way for me to get up close and personal and behind the scenes at how the legislature works here in Oregon as opposed to, let's say, Montana, where I'm from. The commission, as you know, was created in 1997 by the legislature to conduct a continuous program of law reform in the state of Oregon. And one of the ways that we sought to fulfill our purpose this year is to bring forth this bill, which would create a comprehensive code of receivership statutes in Oregon. For those of you who might not know what receivership is, it comes at the request of a property owner's creditors, and it's for the purposes of appointing someone to administer, collect, liquidate, and distribute the property in the case of insolvency of the property owners. This bill is the product of a work group that's been meeting for over a year now, and was comprised of several members who are lawyers, judges, a federal bankruptcy court judge, Judge Alley, as well as a few professional trustees and receivers with general knowledge on receivership. And in forming this bill, the work group looked primarily at Washington's receivership code, as well as the Uniform Law Commission's Uniform Commercial Real Estate and Receivership Act. And with that, I will turn it over to Mark to talk a bit about what the bill actually does.
Morning, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Mark Comstock. I'm a practicing lawyer here in Salem. I am a member of the Law Commission. I've been practicing in civil litigation for 35 years now. I think that I was probably the spark that generated the interest in this bill because in the Oregon Revised Statutes, there's almost 250 references to receiverships or receivers, and various agencies and have the ability to have a receiver appointed to administer something that the agency or a civil litigant seeks to accomplish. Unfortunately, there has not been a comprehensive direction of what a receivership does, how it is administered, and what the powers are of the receivership. That's the scope of what we were trying to define. Previously, existing law, there is a Oregon Rule of Civil Procedure, ORCP 80, that is about two pages long that really does not define how a receivership is operated, but only gives a bare basic premise of when someone may be entitled to seek a receiver appointment in a circuit court proceeding. What this bill, or the amendment to this bill, the proposed amendment, does is fleshes out what the procedures are that are available for appointment of a receiver and how a receivership can be administered. It's quite frankly there to answer the question that was posed to me by circuit judge saying, well, Mr. Comstock, where is it that gives me the power to do what you ask in this action? And what we have here is a comprehensive code of just what is on that menu for a judge. It does not seek to change the way that a receiver is appointed. It simply fleshes out how a receivership can be administered. And we had models, the Uniform Act and also the Washington Receivership Code, upon which parts of the Uniform Act are based. And we had a work group that consisted of judges and lawyers practicing on both sides of receivership law, and two receivers that provided invaluable assistance. We also had the assistance of a very able reporter, Professor Andrea Colbert, who is here, to make sure that we were making something that is workable. And we also had the assistance of legislative counsel to make sure what we were doing was consistent internally and with other provisions. I'm going to turn it over to Professor Colbert to give you a little bit more of the nuts and bolts. Pleasure to answer questions.
All right, thank you, Mark. Professor?
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Colbert. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Oregon School of Law, where I specialize in bankruptcy law. And I was appointed by the Oregon Law Commission to serve and have served as the receiver for this work group. With the committee's busy schedule and the length of this bill, I could just highlight certain provisions from the bill, but of course I'd be happy to do a section-by-section summary if you'd prefer.
I'm not sure if we're quite ready to give them that much legal knowledge. By the end of the session, we'll have their test that they'll have to sit for, especially the new members. So I would just say maybe at this point we'll just give them the Gilberts version.
Okay, excellent. Well, we'll skip through a good part of the beginning. I'll mention Section 6 is the appointment of the receiver, which sets out, among other things, the bases for the appointment of a receiver, and the bases for the appointment speak to the very purpose of a receivership, to protect and preserve value. So things like the possibility that property will be lost or materially impaired, or if perishable property will be destroyed, a receiver could be appointed. Skipping to Section 11, the powers of a receiver. This section, more than any other, provides direction to the court, the kind of direction that Mark spoke about earlier. The section makes explicit the bases of authority and somewhat broadens the provisions of ORCP 80D by setting forth a menu of powers from which a court may choose to confer upon a receiver, powers like collecting, controlling, and managing estate property, operating a business constituting estate property, engaging and compensating professionals, making improvements to estate property, et cetera. Turning to Section 22, which is the automatic stay of certain proceedings. This is a concept borrowed from the Bankruptcy Code and is included also in the Uniform Act. To prevent interference with the receiver's possession and management of estate property or the performance of the receiver's duties, Section 22 provides for a stay, an injunction, which becomes effective automatically upon the entry of the order appointing the receiver. The section provides for certain exceptions to this stay, some of which are borrowed from the Bankruptcy Code as well. It accepts from the stay, for example, criminal proceedings, the commencement or continuation of certain domestic relations actions, including actions to establish paternity. It permits the creditor who sought appointment of the receivership to continue a foreclosure proceeding. For any person whose acts are stayed by this section and not accepted from this section, there's an opportunity for the court to grant relief from the stay for good cause shown. Violations of the stay are voidable, and the court may award actual damages caused by violation of the stay, and the stay terminates upon the termination of the receivership. Another section of importance is Section 24 regarding executory contracts. executory contracts is a defined term under this code. And generally it means contracts on which there are still obligations owing on both sides, by the owner and by the counterparty to the contract. When a receiver, at the time of the appointment of a receivership, an owner is often party to a number of existing contracts to buy or sell goods or services as part of the ongoing business. And the receiver will need to assess the value of those contracts that are beneficial to the receivership, the receiver will want to assume or perform, and those that are burdensome, the receiver will want to reject or breach. And the receiver will need some time to sort out which ones are good and which ones are bad. So Section 24 permits the receiver to do that kind of evaluation of these executory contracts, to assume the good ones and to reject the burdensome ones, and to provide the counterparty to these contracts with assurance of the receiver's ability to perform contracts that the receiver believes are beneficial ones. The court may condition the assumption of these contracts on certain conditions, like curing of defaults under the contract. And until a formal assumption is made by court order, the receiver's performance of a contract doesn't constitute assumption, nor does it preclude rejection of it. It was the intent of the work group to adopt the bankruptcy principle that if a contract it is assumed cum onere, meaning with all of the burdens and benefits of the contract, that the receiver cannot cherry pick provisions of the contract. It has to assume or reject the contract as a whole. And of course, state law will continue to be applicable in determining what that contract is, whether it's what the shape of that contract is. Even beneficial contracts that a receiver seeks to assume are both assets and liabilities, as they'll require the receiver to perform some actions and get the benefits of the other party. I there's more to say about executory contracts, but unless the committee has, there's lots more.
We'll save
and they're
that.
Fascinating. But unless the committee has,
we can save those for questions.
Okay.
If we have those who dare.
Okay. I'll also mention point the committee to Section 25, which governs the use or transfer of estate property outside of the ordinary course of business. And ordinariness, the code leaves up to the court to determine on a case-by-case basis. Generally speaking, the section permits the receiver to use and or transfer estate property outside of the ordinary course of business of the owner's business, and it provides substantial guidance on carrying out and the results of that transfer. Using the estate property outside the ordinary course of business may be a very fruitful source of income for the receivership. For example, the receiver of a vineyard and winery operation may decide to rent out the space for weddings or receptions to raise money. The power of a receiver to sell estate property outside of the ordinary course of the business has not always been clear under the law, particularly when the receiver applied to only particular parcels of property of the owner, the receiver has sometimes thought to have only a custodial function and not an ability to sell. But this act allows the receiver to sell estate property, which is another excellent way of raising money for the receivership. Analogous to a foreclosure sale, the sale by the receiver is free and clear of the lien of the person who obtained appointment of the receiver, and of subordinate liens, but not free of liens that are superior to the appointing to the creditor who sought the appointment. And this is because the nature of subordinate property interests is that they get extinguished by those having priority. And the nature of property interests having priority is that they ride through. Of course, when we say that the sale is free and clear of these liens, the liens attach to the proceeds of the sale. Sales may be by public auction or by private agreement, and there are provisions in the Act that ensure that under either circumstance, the sale will produce the maximum amount of proceeds. There are also provisions in the Act to allow a creditor to credit bid, that is, bid in as a set off against the purchase price the amount of their lien. There are also two provisions designed to provide finality to the purchase and thereby help to enable the receiver to get the maximum amount in proceeds from in the purchase price. First, the sale is free and clear of any right of redemption that the owner may have. I'll just point out that there's a protection in this, written into this Act, that says that the receiver may not sell residential real property, a defined term under this statute, and can't sell it without judicial approval. And that approval won't be granted by the court except where there's instances of waste or destruction, et cetera. Another provision designed to provide finality to sales and therefore raise the purchase price is that the transfer to the purchaser remains valid and the liens that are extinguished under this Act remain extinguished even if after the transfer the order authorizing the transfer is reversed or modified on appeal. And this protection is subject to the requirement that the purchaser has been acting in good faith, which is defined in the Act by both a subjective component, it has to be honesty in fact, and an objective one, that the observance of reasonable, the observance of reasonable commercial standards of fair dealing. The rights of co-owners are protected in a balancing test that takes into account the need for receivers to carry out a transfer of the property. The interest of the co-owner that is not estate property may be transferred along with the interest that is estate property. If the court makes a three-part determination that partition is impracticable, that the sale without the co-owner's interest would realize significantly less for the estate, and that the benefit of the estate of the benefit to the estate of the sale outweighs the detriment to the co-owner. And of course, though not expressly stated in the statute, the partition of the portion of the proceeds that are attributable to the co-owner would be paid to that co-owner because they're not estate property. Those are the highlights. Unless there are other questions, that's all I'll point out for now.
Well, thank you very much for giving us the highlights. So now we're going to see who's daring to ask questions. Questions, Senator Lethicum.
Just a very I'm the new kid, right? So it's easy for me to stick my foot right in the pile. In terms of this, Chair Przanski, you may be able to add to how this works also. In the beginning of this document, it references 248 statutes in ORSs that are splattered throughout. On this document, there's no table of contents or index, and there's no cross-referencing available for finding those things or whatnot. And my curiosity is, from a implementation perspective, how do those get redacted, struck, or or removed from code, or does this replace them? Is this in conjunction with, et cetera? This is quite the extensive read. Having an index or a table of contents would have helped me as I'm slicing through it and wondering and cross-referencing and, you know, et cetera. So that raised the question, there's only three references to specific ORIS, chapters ORIS 87, ORIS 79, and some other ORIS that I can't recall. And yet there's 240 of them splattered out. So it's just a really big, giant, please help.
Mark.
Chair Pazansky, Senator Linthicum. I'll take a stab at it. The Dash 1 amendment is designed to allow the entities, usually state agencies, that have a reference to, they have a ability to seek a receiver in some kind of proceeding. What as to state agencies, and there is only one state agency that has a comprehensive type of receivership procedure, and that is the the Insurance Division of DCBS. What this proposed bill in the amendments does is it excludes application to the insurance code for if the insurance division should seek a receivership over an insurer. So that runs only by the DCBS rules and statutes. As to other agencies that have the ability to seek appointment of a receiver, this bill provides that a state agency or entity can opt in to have this code apply to that proceeding. And that has to be done at the start of the proceeding. So when someone goes to a judge and says, we want a receivership, well, they need to identify whether they're operating under this code or some other proceeding. So we deal with most of the cross-references in that fashion. I do admit that we are relying on legislative counsel to make sure that we've identified all of the references to receiverships, and we believe we have dealt with those in this proceeding. So if an agency does not opt in, they're operating under something different than this proposed amendment. For civil litigants, non-agencies, this code would apply. And just as ORCP 80 is really the only basis for application of to seek a receivership in civil litigation. So we believe we've got it, but we're relying on legislative counsel a bit.
Here's a great project for an extern.
Yes.
So here's the, this is one of those situations that we really can demonstrate how important the Oregon Law Commission is to us as the legislature. Its establishment, as Tyler says, I think was 97. This is something I will say, give credit from my perspective to Lane Shutterly as being one of the catalysts for bringing that forward. I've had the opportunity to serve on it for a number of years, if not all of the time. And it's really when you get what I call the certified smart people in the room from across the state that really know and are willing to put their time in. And this is, as we heard, for this one was over a year project, and some of them are even longer than that. And it does give us that opportunity to have what we hope is the best product we can come up with. And Mark hits it right on the head. You know, legislative council does their best to do what they can. They, of course, have the cross tabs and being able to find the different statutes that might need to be amended to conform with the change that we're making. But it's also one of those situations that don't be surprised in 2 years. Maybe something was missed and we'll have a correction. That's where we see a lot of times where we are doing amendments to something that comes in the year before or 2 years before, because, you know, unfortunately, we missed a cross-section tab. So it's one of those situations that this will, in fact, give uniformity across the state. And I think the key part here is really for the civil litigants, meaning the individuals in the state using the courts for receivership. Everyone will have the same approach and process and procedure to use, and it will give that uniformity and certainty throughout the state for judges that are faced with receiverships to be able to have a code to follow. Senator Denbrough.
I do have a question to follow up. I really appreciate the work that went into this and the clarity that it's going to provide. Do you anticipate that it will actually change practice in some ways, having this, you know, this the statutes clarified in this way?
Chair Przanski, Senator Denbrough, it will change practice somewhat, but it does not change the bases when someone seeks a receivership. That is still under the same rubric of ORCP 80. So the litigants need to go in and prove their case of entitlement. Then thereafter, it gives a roadmap of how a receivership can operate, and litigants have the ability to, assuming this is adopted, to point to a provision in the law that says it's supposed to work this way, and then they can bring that to the court. So it doesn't change the balance of power, if you will. It does give direction to how things are supposed to occur and gives direction to what the court can do and how they can tailor this to work for the particular proceeding in front of them.
Okay. So just for the record, ORCP, Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, that's what we're referring to as to how this fits in and where it fits in. And it is basically the process that will be used and the procedure for litigants as well as for the courts and how to actually administer a receivership. Any other comments or questions?
Just briefly, Senator Przanski, the commission would ask that the Dash 1 amendment be adopted and that when it is appropriate that the bill be referred out with a due pass recommendation.
All right, thank you very much. And that's the plan. Senator Thatcher.
Just a question about the emergency clause.
Mm-hmm.
What is the necessity of it?
All right, so I'm not sure, Mark, if you know the discussions that we've been having regarding emergency clauses. The question really is, was this something that the commission thought was necessary to enact as immediacy to actually put it in place? Normally, it would go into effect on January 1 the following year, unless we have another date. And the other option we normally would consider besides an emergency clause is after 90 days to allow for those who might want to referendum the legislation to the voters.
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, the emergency clause is on the underlying bill, but that's removed by the Dash 1 amendments.
It is. Okay. Thank you. I appreciate
it. So we're saved by the Dash 1s once again.
That's exactly correct, Senator Przanski, because I did not have an answer for why there was an emergency clause, because it's not here.
And that's why we
just gets put in there without asking for it. Does. Well, so, yeah.
And that's why Chana's here to make sure we're going it right. So the bottom line is that this will go into effect on January 1, 2018. That should allow for all the parties and all the practitioners in the state to have opportunity and time to modify their practice to be able and be ready to use it when it goes into effect.
Yes.
All right. Any other comments or questions? All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Let me ask if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 899. Didn't think there'd be too many people running up here. And with that, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. We don't have the opportunity to move the bill today because we're waiting for paperwork. This is just one of those bills I wish we had known that was coming through. We could have saved one of our two members to carry one of these. These are the type of ones that I'm always looking for great volunteers. So with that, we are closed the public hearing. We're now going to open up our last public hearing for today, which is Senate Bill 927. And Michael, I believe this is the one that you're overseeing.
Thank you, Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee. Senate Bill 927 provides sellers and lessors of law enforcement dogs with immunity from liability under product liability statutes for injuries caused by their dogs. The immunity provision would take effect once the dog has started a training program approved by a law enforcement agency or accredited and recognized by an animal handling organization. There are no amendments, and there is no fiscal or revenue impact.
All right, thank you. So we have Officer Darren Kendrick from Springfield. Darren, why don't you come up with your trusted colleague, and Karen, Kevin, I think you're going to join us. And while Darren's getting set, Darren approached me during the interim as to an issue that we're going to hear a little bit more about, and this is why we have the legislation before us. So, Darren, I need you to just put your name on the record, and if you'll tell us the reason why we have the bill.
Thank you. Senator Prozonsky, members of the committee, thank you for having me here. My name is Darren Kendrick. I'm a police officer with the City of Springfield and also the president of the Oregon Police Canine Association.
And you should address ours, introduce your colleague.
This is my partner, Janko, and he's better than any human partner I've had. Yeah. So I win all the arguments. Janko is a German Shepherd, and he's trained in patrol work, tracking and protection. Sir, the reason that this bill came forward is in 2012, an officer was bit by his agency's police dog. At that time, he sued the vendor of the dog that brought the dog from Europe over here, and said that it was in the product liability law, and it was a faulty product. During that time, the vendor was found not culpable of that, but the vendor told us that he spent approximately $5,000 to sell a $10,000 dog, and he wasn't interested in keep on paying out to defend that. He told us then at that time in 2015 that he wasn't going to sell police dogs to Oregon anymore until we could figure out some way to exempt the police dogs from that. The situation was that when the dog was purchased, it came over from Europe. The vendor brought it over, and at that time, then the agency selected the dog and brought the dog back, put the dog through training, and then the incident happened. So that this bill would exempt. Sorry. This bill would exempt police dogs that are going through training and or have completed training from the product liability law at that situation.
All right. Kevin.
Chair Prozonsky and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today, of course, on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police to speak in favor of the bill. It's a statewide issue, and it impacts not just this vendor, but other vendors as well. The key here is that once the dog begins training, the vendor itself does not have control over the training process. And so holding the vendor liable for the actions of a dog following the training process is something that we believe would create a chilling effect on our ability to get beautiful canines like Django, because I think that's the key. And so we're very supportive of this, and this was identified as a statewide concern, and we appreciate, Mr. Chair, your willingness to sponsor the bill, and for Springfield PD for kind of leading the effort. So thank you.
Yeah. So just to put on the record, this is the situation that because the vendor that that the dog in question came from is a primary supplier of dogs to the state of Oregon, agencies throughout the state. His position basically was, and my understanding, other states have in fact limited product liability type of claims against a vendor of a canine for this purpose. And this is one of those, you know, say, unique situations where an attorney found a way to maybe hit what they thought was be, I'm going to say, deep pockets, also a way to get around from going through workers' comp, because this was a situation where the officer who was bit was part of the agency of the dog that was the biter. And this normally would have gone through through a workers' comp, but for whatever reason, they chose to try to, I'm going to say, bypass it, but go for relief by bringing in the vendor of the dog. When Darren and I met, it became very apparent to me that it was very important for us to ensure that we have a good, reliable source of dogs for the state of Oregon. And this particular vendor is out of California, and I believe every dog that I've have had the opportunity to be acquainted to have come from the same vendor, the one out of Riverside, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
And so this is one of those situations that we just need to ensure that we still have the, call it the pipeline of dogs being able to be brought in for the police work they do. And to ensure, and in this particular case, there was relief for that individual. It's just that we're just not going to allow them to go after the vendor of the dog based on product liability. So, questions? Senator Manning.
Yeah, just briefly, beautiful dog, by the way.
Thank you, sir. Yeah.
Too bad I can't have a chance to play with him for a little while. But
anyway. We can make that happen.
We can make that happen.
Yeah. So just wondering now, the incident that occurred was another officer was bit. Are there any incidents there was anyone outside of the training area, like civilians or, you know, community members and stuff, that the dog, and this particular dog in question, inadvertently bit or anything like that?
Chair Przanski and Senator Manning, the answer to that is this dog, the situation was that it was Sherwood Police Department. The dog was out exercising, relieving himself in their back secured parking lot. And the handler let the dog off the leash to go and do that. Then the officer who got bit came out the back door. He said that the dog just made eye contact with him and ran right at him. The canine handler said he had a water bottle in his hand and was playing with the water bottle, crunching it and things like that, and the dog was coming over to see what it was. We played tug with our dogs quite a bit, tug toys and everything else. The handler said that the dog went up, looked like he was going to grab the water bottle, and the officer went to swat at the dog, and then the dog got that hand. And during that process, the handler was trying to hit him to get him off. And then eventually, when the dog did come off, and they took him in, and he was injured, and there was no doubt about it. But workman's comp paid for it, and that sort of thing. One of the things that I teach my guys at work is the dog is a dog, and we have these leashes that, you know, we control our dogs at all times, whether it's through voice, whether it's through leash or whatnot, and we make sure they're under control. And that's one of the things as a trainer I would do. And as the vendor, he's not there, and the vendor hardly ever sees who the canine handler is going to be for that dog. And he just sells it to the department, and then the department's trainer takes it back and goes through the training process with the new handler. And so if that answered your question.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, I was just wondering, you know, if there were for the particular dog, if, you know, like you're out on patrol or something like that, the dog had maybe bit somebody, you know, taunting the dog or, you know, just right. Walking by. I don't think that's the case, but I was just asking.
Right. Yeah. I'm not 100% sure with that particular dog.
Yeah, I mean, for that particular dog, not sure. But the bottom line is, like, when I've done ride-alongs, there's an officer who's now retired, Tom Schilke, was a canine at one time. And you know, I watch the dogs work, and I watch them out there and play. And the reality is they give you instructions as to what you do or what you don't do, because the dog's there to work, and it will work.
Yeah.
And there are times where there are bites that may not be a founded bite. But the course of the recourse, I guess I would say, is a suit against the city or the agency by the civilian as to the dog. Clearly, if you had a dog that continued to act out, the agency and the jurisdiction are probably going to be thinking whether or not that dog should stay active on the force, because if it has that pro tendency to not be able to be maintained and controlled. So there are ways of having relief. Again, that a civilian would not be able under this bill to go after the vendor of the dog. It would have to go against the officer, the handler, and or basically that would mean the city or the county or state police, whoever the agency was.
I agree with that. I just have problems with the term product liability, you know, when referring to a dog. You know, it's not like something, you know, we have an assembly line where we're manufacturing, but I'm okay.
Well, like I said, you know, it took the uniqueness of an attorney to be thinking probably in the wee hours of the morning to come up with that one, but they did. So, all right. Any other questions or comments? Darren, thank you very much for being here. We're going to go ahead and let me just ask if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 927. Not seeing one, we'll close the public hearing, and we're going to go ahead and open up the work session on Senate Bill 927.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 927 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 927 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. Chair will carry the bill to the floor. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 927. And we'll open up our last work session for the day, Senate Bill 769. And Chen, if you'll give us an overview, please.
Certainly, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 769, you heard on March 6th. This deals with the publicly posted or publicly displayed social security numbers of consumers. This was from the case where the 30 boxes of unredacted mortgage documents were placed in the dumpster. We had a few questions about this and a few concerns. We've come back with the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments specify that a person may not dispose of or transfer to another for disposal any material displaying a consumer's social security number unless the person makes the number unreadable or unrecoverable, or ensures that the person that they've transferred it to is making it unreadable or unrecoverable. One of the other concerns that we heard about from a member of the bar was the transfer of documents that are made in the course of business. So, for example, an attorney who sends their documents to a client in a bankruptcy proceeding, and that includes a full social security number on that. Current law prohibits that practice within this statute, but it may be exempt under other statutes that exist. It is not dealt with by the Dash 1. It's a larger discussion that needs to be had amongst other stakeholders about whether that needs to change or not. So that particular concern is not addressed by the Dash 1s, but the concern with transferring documents to a third party for disposal is.
All right. So basically what we're looking at is trying to fix a part of a problem today that's probably more universal application as it pertains to the second thing of either an attorney, and I assume without looking at the statutes that you have accountants who already have some type of cover or protection of moving tax prepared documents back and forth without being caught up in this. And just, Chen, if you put that on the record.
Chair Przewski, that's correct.
Okay. So at this point, the chair is comfortable moving forward with the Dash 1s, understanding that there will be additional discussion. Based on what I'm hearing at this point, it sounds like what we need to do is have a much larger discussion, broader group of people, and that may not be able to be occur during this session. We do have placeholder bills that we could potentially use if we were able to reach that, but if not, then that would be something we'll probably take up during the interim and have an opportunity to bring something forward in the short session, because that's, to me, one of the reasons that we have the short session and the ability to bring bills, policy stuff, so we can address ongoing issues that just can't get addressed at, on the immediacy. So,
would you like a motion?
I would love a motion.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to, which one are we on? Senate Bill 769. Sorry, I was one behind there.
That's caught it right.
Senate Bill 769.
Senator Thatcher moves the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 769. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Thatcher?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 769 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher now moves Senate Bill 769 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And is anyone wanting to carry this? I was going to ask Senator Lithicum if you'd be willing to carry it.
Sure.
Trying to make sure we balance stuff out. If that's okay, then we'll go ahead and close the work session on 769. And I believe that takes care of the work that we have for today. And today being Thursday, we're not scheduled to meet tomorrow. So we'll be here next Monday at 8:30. With that, the committee's adjourned.
Yeah,
we're still.